an extra $300 in weekly payments. Federal appeals court rejects Texas Democrats' effort to expand voting by mail. U.S. Senator John Cornyn suggests Trump could have struck a better balance in discussing early coronavirus threat. Those stories and more will be coming up this hour. First, we'll look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 4,433. Ector County negative, 19,974 out of 24,730 tested, with 323 pending, 78 deaths. Recovered, 3,716. Active, 639. Midland County, 3,421 confirmed, 75 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, Texas approaching 14,000 total coronavirus deaths as hospitalizations and daily new cases continue to fall. 3,575 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 10th, 500 less than a week ago. They occupy 6.5% of hospital beds. 3,852 new cases were reported on September 10th. The latest positivity rate is 7.8%. 13,853 Texans have died as of September 10th. 161 more deaths reported than the day before, 762 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate crude today is trading at $37.57, which is up 31 cents. The latest Texas unemployment figures, more than 3.4 million Texans have filed for unemployment relief since mid-March. The unemployment rate in Texas is 8%. Now here are coronavirus briefs. Hopes for a new stimulus package to help ease the economic stress of the coronavirus pandemic before the November elections waned Thursday after Democrats blocked a slimmed-down coronavirus relief bill put forward by GOP leaders. Many of the benefits created in the CARES Act, passed by Congress in March, have expired, and 29 million Americans drew jobless aid last week, according to Labor Department data. Harvard University research suggests young people are more at risk from the virus than previously assumed. A study of more than 3,000 hospitalized patients aged 18 to 34 found that 20% needed intensive care, 10% needed a ventilator, and 2.7% died. A CDC study found that people with COVID-19 were twice as likely as those without the disease to have recently eaten in a restaurant, a disturbing revelation as several states moved to loosen public dining restrictions. The U.S. coronavirus death toll has surpassed 188,000, and at least 6,366,000 cases have been reported. An ensemble forecast by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now projects there will be up to 217,000 COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. by October 3rd. People who may have relaxed social distancing precautions over Labor Day weekend should get tested for the virus, Dr. Deborah Burke said. Major League Baseball reports no positive tests among players in the latest COVID-19 results. Now here are some short articles. America mourns 9/11 tragedy amid pandemic. Every year, Americans have honored the nearly 3,000 people lost in the catastrophic 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001 by gathering in stately ceremonies, sharing inconsolable tears. But this year's rituals were distanced, and bereaved faces were covered by masks, as at least 188,000 people have died in the last 6 months, while the nation battles a new disaster, the coronavirus pandemic. The presidential candidates, President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden, both visited the 9/11 memorial at the United Airlines Flight 93 crash site in Sharksville, Pennsylvania. In a morning ceremony, Trump gave prepared remarks to a socially distanced audience and participated in a wreath-laying ceremony with the family members of a flight attendant killed in the Pennsylvania crash. although the candidates did not meet, Biden and Vice President Pence did, with the politicians bumping elbows and greeting. Biden and his wife Jill also traveled to the Twin Towers site in Manhattan, where the Democratic candidate spoke with a 90-year-old mother of a man killed during the attack. A brief one-on-one interaction during a campaign season that has had few opportunities for intimate moments. In Washington, members of Congress, led by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, spaced across Capitol steps for a moment of silence. Despite restrictions, some tributes were unwavering this year. The annual tribute of shining double beams of light at night in New York City in the shape of the fallen Twin Towers was canceled, but then reinstated by the Tunnel to Towers Foundation, an organization that commemorates first responders. I am glad that we can continue this powerful tribute to those we lost on 9/11 and to all the heroism of all New Yorkers, Governor Andrew M. Cuomo said when the lights were announced in August. The virus has taken so much and so many, but now the tribute will continue. Fauci to Americans, hunker down this fall. Nearly 30 U.S. states are reporting downward trends in COVID-19 cases, but the pandemic will likely worsen again, according to the country's leading infectious disease expert. We need to hunker down and get through this fall and winter because it's not going to be easy, Dr. Fauci said Thursday. The warning isn't new. Experts, including the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention director, have long warned the months ahead will be challenging. It doesn't help that the U.S. continues to see about 36,000 new cases each day, which is better than we were in August, but still too high, according to Fauci. I keep looking at that curve and I get more depressed and more depressed about the fact that we never really get down to the baseline that I'd like, he said. There's a lot that could potentially help drive COVID-19 numbers up in the fall as the fall season arrives. Colleges nationwide have become hotspots for the virus weeks after reopening. And when students return back home, which health officials have urged against, they could transmit the disease to more communities. As the weather gets colder, the activities Americans enjoy will likely move indoors, where the virus can spread more easily. The pandemic will also soon be stacked on top of the flu season, meaning doctors will have a harder time differentiating patients who may have COVID-19 from those who have been infected with the flu. 1 in 5 hospitalized young people need ICU care, and many need ongoing care after clearing the virus, new research says. Although young adults are not as likely as older people to suffer serious complications from the novel coronavirus, a new research letter from Harvard University suggests a significant number may be at risk for harsh and possibly lasting impacts on their health. Researchers reviewed 3,222 coronavirus cases in which adults ages 18 to 34 needed hospitalization. They found that about 1 in 5 of those hospitalized required intensive care, 10% needed a ventilator, and 2.7% died. Another 3% required ongoing medical care in a post-acute treatment facility even after clearing the virus. The proportion of young people who have contracted the virus has increased in recent months as cities and states have relaxed restrictions on businesses and some people have returned to work. The World Health Organization warned last month that young adults are emerging as the primary spreaders of the virus in many countries. And as many college campuses open for the fall semester, universities have seen rapid moving outbreaks rip through student bodies and force thousands of young people to self-isolate. The researchers found that some pre-existing conditions like hypertension, diabetes, and obesity were more prevalent among the young patients who had severe health impacts or who died from the virus. Men were also more likely than women to develop serious or life-threatening conditions. More than half of the hospitalized patients were Black or Hispanic. The virus has killed Black Americans at a disproportionate rate. Given the sharply rising rates of COVID-19 infection in young adults, these findings underscore the importance of infection prevention measures in this age group, the research team wrote. Coronavirus long hauler describes what it's like to have scary symptoms for 6 months. Jennifer Johnston, a 40-year-old Oregon mother who has been battling coronavirus for 6 months, has been in the hospital multiple times after experiencing symptoms, including extremely high blood pressure, trouble standing, and loss of memory. "I can only stand for a few minutes at a time. I turn purple, my hands and legs, and I get lightheaded," she said on CNN's New Day. "My heart rate doubles just standing, and I have blurry eyes. I feel like I'm going to faint, in and out, most days. I can't watch TV or read, and my memory's gone," she added. Johnston said she tries not to go to the emergency room. "Otherwise, I'd be there every night. But last weekend, her symptoms got so bad for days that she had to call a doctor. At night, I wake up and I gasp for air pretty often, and my whole left side goes numb. My blood pressure skyrockets to really scary ranges, and my heart rate gets to like 180, which is really fast," she said. "Doctors seem flummoxed by her situation," she said, "and are treating her symptom by symptom. She's on heart medication and multiple vitamins to try to help." CDC says COVID-19 death rate is under 1% for everyone but people over 70. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said Thursday it had changed the way it was reporting death rates for coronavirus and will now report the infection fatality ratio by age. It's all still based on approximations. And as part of the update, the CDC also estimates it's missing most cases of coronavirus in the U.S. by a factor of 11. According to the updated best estimate, numbers posted on the agency's website, 0.003% of children 18 and younger who are infected with coronavirus die. The fatality rate is 0.02% of people aged 20 to 49, 0.5% of people aged 50 to 69, 5.4% of people 70 and older. Transmission time. Under the best estimate scenario, it takes about 6 days on average for people to develop symptoms after they've been in contact with the virus. ICU care. Just below 24% of people under the age of 50 who are hospitalized will need ICU care, the CDC estimates. This rises to 36% of people 50 to 64 and 35% of people 65 and older. Fatality rate for those hospitalized. About 2.4% of people ages 18 to 49 who are hospitalized die, the CDC estimates. It rises to 10% of those 50 to 64 who are hospitalized, and more than 26% of people over 65 who are hospitalized. Not only are the numbers an estimate, but reports of death rates lag by weeks, the CDC said. On average, it takes about 45 days for a coronavirus death to be reported. Asymptomatic cases. The CDC calculates that 40% of cases are asymptomatic, and that these people without symptoms are about 75% as infectious as people with symptoms, although this is highly uncertain. Infection fatality ratio is one of several ways of reporting mortality rates. It's calculated by dividing the number of deaths by the number of actual infections. And since the true number of coronavirus infections is not known, it is by necessity an estimate. AstraZeneca says it could still have vaccine approval by the end of this year, even with recent setback. AstraZeneca should still be on track to have a set of data to submit for approval of a COVID-19 vaccine before the end of the year, despite having to pause the trial because of an illness in a volunteer, company CEO Pascal Soriot said Thursday. It depends on how fast the regulator will review and give approval, Soriot told Britain's Tortoise Media during an online event about the pandemic. So we could still have a vaccine by the end of this year, maybe out next year. By the end of this year is still feasible. Now we'll switch to economic news for the moment. Pandemic bankruptcies, a running list of retailers that have filed for Chapter 11. The retail industry, in turmoil for years, is facing its biggest test yet as the coronavirus crisis pushes some of the nation's most vulnerable brands to the economic brink. Pandemic-motivated closures and stalling demand left by many prominent retailers looking for ways to preserve cash. Some stopped paying rent. Others furloughed workers, cut executive pay, and canceled orders for new inventory. But as the economy begins sputtering back to life, bankruptcy attorneys and analysts say a growing number of companies will find they just don't have enough cash to keep going. Analysts say the ongoing uncertainty from the pandemic and deepening recession makes it difficult to pinpoint exactly where many of these national chains will end up after filing for bankruptcy. Many are expected to close hundreds, even thousands, of underperforming stores while trying to shore up the rest of their operations. Others, like Stage Stores and Lord & Taylor, have said they will liquidate all stores while searching for a buyer. Here is a running tally of pandemic-era bankruptcy filings. 1. J. Crew. Annual revenue, $2.5 billion in 2019. Number of stores, 492. Founded, 1947. On May 4th, J. Crew, the clothing chain known for its preppy basics, became the first major U.S. retailer to file for Chapter 11 protection. The 73-year-old New York-based company was struggling to stay relevant long before the outbreak forced it to temporarily shutter all 492 of its J. Crew and Madwell stores. Analysts say missteps in both fashion and finance have left the one-time mall darling with slipping sales and nearly $2 billion in debt. Though J. Crew has not announced any store closures, analysts warn that the financial fallout from the temporary closures and reduced sales will have a domino effect across the industry, permanently altering shopping malls across the country. 2. Neiman Marcus. Annual revenue, $4.9 billion in 2018. Number of stores, 43. Founded, 1907. Neiman Marcus Group, the 113-year-old chain known for its high-end department stores, filed for bankruptcy on May 7th. The Dallas-based retailer has struggled to pay down $5 billion in debt, much of it from leveraged buyouts in 2005 and 2013. The pandemic has forced it to temporarily shutter all 43 of its stores and furlough most of its 14,000 workers. In addition to its namesake stores, it also owns Bergdorf, Goodman, Horchow, and Mytheresa. 3. Stage Stores. Annual revenue, $1.58 billion in 2018. Number of stores, 738. Founded, 1988. Stage Stores, which operates hundreds of stores, including Bell's, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy on May 10th. The Houston-based company said it is searching for a buyer as it liquidates its stores. The retailer has 738 locations across half a dozen brands, including the off-price Gordman's chain and the Peebles and Stage department stores in small towns and rural areas in 42 states. 4. JCPenney. Annual revenue, $12.02 billion in 2019. Number of stores, 850. Founded, 1902. Department store chain JCPenney filed for bankruptcy protection on May 15th and said it would permanently close some of its 850 locations. The 118-year-old retailer was struggling long before the public health crisis forced it to temporarily shutter its stores and furlough the majority of its 90,000 employees. It has nearly $4 billion in debt and hasn't turned a profit since 2010. Sales have fallen for four straight years as it struggled to win back longtime loyalists who have since gravitated to big box chains such as Target and Costco to outfit their families. In a bankruptcy filing, JCPenney said it has both assets and liabilities between $1 billion and $10 billion, and it owes money to more than 100,000 creditors. It also said it would close some stores, but did not provide details on where or when. 5. Tuesday morning. Annual revenue, $1 billion in 2019. Number of stores, 687. Founded, 1974. Discount retailer Tuesday Morning filed for bankruptcy on May 27th and said it will shut 230 locations, roughly one-third of its store holdings, this summer after the coronavirus outbreak disrupted sales. In its bankruptcy filing, the Dallas-based home goods chain said it owed between $50 million and $100 million to as many as 5,000 creditors. Analysts say the retailer has struggled to set itself apart from competitors such as Home Goods, Ross Stores, and Macy's Backstage outlets, which have gained popularity in recent years. Tuesday Morning stores, they say, tend to be unorganized and overwhelming with a mishmash of less than exciting inventory. Many stores are not so much an Aladdin's cave of exciting treasures as a jumbled flea market of whatever buyers could seemingly get their hands on. Neil Saunders, managing director of Global Data Retail, wrote in a note to clients, "Putting together a range requires enormous skill and a certain degree of flair. In our view, Tuesday Morning lacks both." 6. GNC Holdings. Annual revenue, $2.07 billion in 2019. Number of stores, 5,200 U.S. stores. Founded, 1935. Vitamin and nutrition chain GNC Holdings filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy on June 23rd, with plans to close up to 1,200 U.S. stores as it searches for a buyer. GNC, General Nutrition Centers, was the country's go-to retailer for vitamins, protein powders, and nutritional supplements. But in recent years, it has struggled for years to shore up sales as it tried to pay back more than $9 million in debt. Then came the coronavirus pandemic, which forced it to shutter about 40% of its stores, leading to millions in lost revenue. The company reported a $200 million loss during the first quarter of this year, and last month warned that some of the company's temporary closures could soon turn permanent. 7. Lucky Brand Dungarees. Annual revenue not reported. Number of stores, about 200. Founded, 1990. Denim retailer Lucky Brand Dungarees filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy on July 3rd and announced plans to sell the company after the coronavirus crisis caused demand for jeans and other apparel to evaporate. 8. Brooks Brothers. Annual revenue, roughly $1 billion. Number of stores, 250 U.S. stores. Founded, 1818. Brooks Brothers, the country's oldest clothing retailer, filed for bankruptcy protection on July 8th, as it continues to search for a buyer. The brand, best known for its sharp Oxfords, classic suits, and polos, has dressed nearly every U.S. president, as well as legions of business executives. The company is set to close 51 of its 250 North American stores and will halt production at its factories in Massachusetts, North Carolina, and New York in mid-August, which produce less than 7% of its finished goods. Remaining stores will reopen in compliance with local public health orders tied to pandemic-related closures. 9. Ascena Retail Group. Annual revenue, $5.5 billion in 2019. Number of stores, 2,800. founded 1962. Ascena Retail Group, the conglomerate behind women's apparel brands Ann Taylor, Lane Bryant, and Catherine's, filed for bankruptcy on July 23rd and said it would close about 1,100 of its 2,800 stores after years of declining sales and ballooning debt. 10. Tailored Brands. Annual revenue, $2.9 billion in 2019. Number of stores, 1,400. Founded, 1973. Tailored Brands Incorporated, the parent company of Men's Warehouse, Joseph A. Bank, K&G, and Moores, filed for Chapter 11 protection on August 2nd, the same day as department store chain Lord & Taylor. The filing comes less than 2 weeks after the retailer announced plans to slash its corporate headcount by 20% and rearrange its store lineup and supply chain infrastructure to prioritize e-commerce. At the time, the company had reopened nearly all 1,274 stores in the United States and 125 stores in Canada. 11. Steinmart. Annual revenue, $1.2 billion in 2019. Number of stores, 281. Founded, 1908. Discount chain Steinmart filed for bankruptcy on August 12th and announced plans to close most, if not all, of its stores across the country as it searches for a buyer for its e-commerce business. The Jacksonville, Florida-based company said it had run out of cash to keep operating during the pandemic, despite a $10 million small business loan from the government's Paycheck Protection Program. In its bankruptcy filing, it said it owed between $500 million and $1 billion to as many as 10,000 lenders. Used car sales are booming, and that's pushing up inflation. Used car sales are booming so much they pushed up consumer price inflation last month. Prices for used cars and trucks climbed 5.4%, the largest monthly increase since March 1969, and contributed 40% to the core inflation index, which strips out items that tend to be volatile in price, like food and energy. The categories with the highest increases tell the tale of today's economy. Robert Frick, corporate economist with Navy Federal Credit Union, said, "The demand for these is stiff, given the high expense of new cars, and that people are closely watching their spending while the economy is depressed by the pandemic. People are also abandoning air travel during the pandemic and hitting the road after being cooped up at home for much of the spring and summer. And it doesn't hurt that gas prices in the U.S. are cheaper than they've been in years." U.S. core consumer prices rose 0.4% in August on a seasonally adjusted basis, less than the 0.6% increase in July. Prices for air travel, shelter, recreation, and household furnishings also rose, contributing to the increase. Meanwhile, the overall consumer price index also increased 0.4% in August on a seasonally adjusted basis. Over the past 12 months, the index increased 1.3% before seasonal adjustments. That's a significant jump, as back in May, the 12-month increase was only 0.1% after prices got clobbered during the spring lockdown. Now we're going to go to the first of our pre-recorded reports. This is a related story. From NPR, COVID-19 is changing the way we spend money, affecting inflation.
A few days ago, we heard an assessment of the economy. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said Congress needs to act as the recovery gets harder.
Those sorts of things are for Congress to decide, but I do think there's agreement that something needs to get done, and my guess is that in time, more will be done, and certainly I think more will be needed.
More will be needed, but Congress has not acted for now. Senate Democrats rejected a Republican version of the latest relief bill. Republicans have rejected the Democratic version. So for the moment, you're on your own. NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley has been asking how the pandemic is stressing the finances of American families. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What makes the Fed chairman and, frankly, a lot of lawmakers think the economy could use more help?
The economy has bounced partway back from the recession, but there's still a long way to go, and the steepest part of the hill might be ahead of us. We have recovered so far less than half the jobs that were lost this spring. Job gains have been slowing, and we continue to see large numbers of people filing claims for unemployment week after week. It's also been 6 weeks since those unemployment benefits were cut by $600 a week.
Mm-hmm. So you've been asking how all this is affecting the way people spend their money. What are you finding?
Credit and debit card records show spending growth has kind of stalled since the latter part of June. It is well below pre-pandemic levels in most categories. One exception, though, is groceries. Spending on groceries is up, and so are prices. That's put the squeeze on some families. I talked this week with Gwen Mickens in Tampa. She complained that a recent trip to the supermarket set her back more than $250.
Short ribs are like twice as much as they used to be. And, of course, the bacon is more expensive as well, and dairy products. And you kind of close your eyes and just pick it up and throw it in the grocery cart.
Mickens was shopping for herself, her husband, and their grown son. She really worries about how bigger families might be coping.
I'm wondering, how do they make it? It has to be extremely hard.
Michelle Ellerhoff has two kids at home, ages 10 and 12. Her grocery bills have also gone up.
They eat so much, so just to try to keep up with them and not having school lunches did increase my budget.
And to make matters worse, Ellerhoff lost a freezer full of groceries last month when that big windstorm ripped through eastern Iowa where she lives and knocked out power for a week. She's still trying to restock.
I'm going slowly with that. It's just too overwhelming to do it all at once.
The pandemic has also made it harder to go bargain hunting in the grocery aisle. Nancy Gaston of Vancouver, Washington, used to study supermarket flyers and online coupons, but she's not doing that these days.
I used to go to two and sometimes three different stores in the course of a week, and I just want to limit social contacts, and so I go to one store a week, usually on Sunday morning because nobody else is there.
As a result, Gaston is paying more for groceries, but she is saving money in other areas.
Haircuts, manicures, and gasoline. I went 2.5 months between fill-ups of the gas tank on my car because we're simply not going anywhere.
Lots of people are making similar adjustments. But economists say that's not being picked up by the government's official yardstick of inflation, the Consumer Price Index. That's important because CPI is used to calculate cost of living increases for all kinds of things, including Social Security. It also helps to guide policymakers as they try to figure out what kind of medicine an ailing economy needs.
Scott, why isn't the Consumer Price Index capturing those rising prices?
The government tries to measure inflation by tracking the prices on a big basket of goods and services. But in real life, consumers' baskets have changed during the pandemic. We're spending more on things like groceries, where prices have gone up, and less on things like air travel and concert tickets, where the prices have come down. Harvard economist Alberto Cavallo has crafted a special COVID CPI that tries to account for those changes and to measure the inflation that consumers are actually feeling in their pocketbooks.
When you take into account these changes in consumption patterns, it turns out the inflation levels are significantly higher. I would say about 1% more on an annual basis.
The official CPI for August, which came out this morning, shows fairly tepid inflation overall, prices up just 1.3% over the last year. But grocery prices are up 4.6%. And unfortunately, that falls hardest on those who can least afford it.
NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley, thanks.
You're welcome.
You're on Texas Standard Time.
John Cornyn has been in his current office since 2002, and many believe he's in the toughest race of his political career this year, facing Democratic challenger M.J. Hager. Yesterday, when we spoke with him, he just returned to D.C. from Austin as lawmakers were taking up an issue critical to many Texans right now, relief to help weather the pandemic. Many lives and livelihoods have been put on hold by shutdowns and social distancing requirements. And initial assistance from the federal government has dried up in many quarters. Now the senior senator from Texas is among the Republicans trying to push through another aid package, one that many Democrats are not on board with, as it's considerably more modest than their own proposal. Senator John Cornyn of Texas, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Great to be with you. Well, U.S. senators back from their summer recess this week, and we've been hearing about divisions between parties holding up the passing of another major coronavirus aid package. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was announcing that Republicans in the Senate, including yourself, will vote to advance an emergency stimulus plan. What does that plan include?
Well, this will include what I would call the bipartisan consensus items that were previously a part of the Republican offer, which was called the HEALS Act. As you know, that was about $1 trillion worth of additional spending. And the Speaker Pelosi and House Democrats had countered that with a $3 trillion additional spending bill called the HEROES Act. But that's on top of the $3 trillion we've already spent through four different pieces of legislation, culminating in the CARES Act in late March. But I think there's still work that needs to be done.
Is your objection to the Democrats' plan that it's too expensive?
It is that it includes a lot of non-COVID-related issues. For example, it includes a tax cut for some of the wealthiest people in large blue states like New York and California. And it also includes a variety of different things to support the cannabis industry. And just it's really a grab bag of a lot of different unrelated things. What we need to do is recognize that we're in a two-front war. One is a public health battle, and the other is an economic recession caused by the mitigation efforts. And I think we need to focus on those things and leave these other issues for a later fight on another day.
You know, I think everyday Texans are concerned about how they're going to pay their next month's rent or their mortgage. What about that $600 a week unemployment benefit? Is that going to be reinstated in the Republican plan?
Well, we're going to pay out another direct payment to individuals through no fault of their own, as you point out, or out of work or working reduced hours. And then there will be a reinstatement of the unemployment insurance supplement. The exact amount is not the subject of an agreement, but under the president's executive order now, it's an additional $300 a week. There were some people receiving actually more money not working than to work, which is not obviously our intention to incentivize people to stay away from work if they can safely return, but merely to replace their lost wages. So that's something we still have to work out.
Well, now the August jobs report shows unemployment rate falling below 10% for the first time since the nation went on lockdown. But the Washington Post is reporting just over half of the 22 million total jobs lost between February and April have not returned. What does a Senate Republican measure do to address that consideration? Because that's a serious figure there.
Well, it is, and it's not going to change until we are able to navigate this virus and to get on with our lives safely. And we're seeing this playing out right now with kids going back to school, college students returning to college. But I think we've learned a lot of lessons. The vaccine is probably not going to be here until the latter part of the year or the beginning of next year. So what we all need to do is take personal responsibility, which is to wash your hands, wear masks, socially distance, and stay home when you're sick. And what we've seen is that actually has a pretty impressive impact in terms of bringing down the spreading of the virus. But that's going to be the formula until we can get that vaccine. I know Governor Abbott and others are looking at what else we can do to reopen to hopefully get people back to work and help grow our economy, because we can't sustain this situation forever where millions of Americans are out of work.
Let me ask you something, Senator. This administration as a whole, how do you think the overall response has been to the COVID crisis? And what are you telling Texans as you're campaigning, Texans who are out of a job or worried about their kids going back to school?
Well, this pandemic is something that nobody saw coming. And it's created an unprecedented experience, and it's been dramatic, and it's been painful. And I really feel particularly for people who are out of work and not receiving any income because of the mitigation efforts. And that's why I voted for $3 trillion worth of emergency spending, something I would never do except under circumstances like this. But we didn't know how long this is going to last. We had hoped that would be in better shape than we are right now. We are starting to see some encouraging numbers coming from the from the efforts that we're all undertaking. As I said, each of us have a personal role we can play in slowing down and hopefully slowing down that spread. But I think you know, there's always room for criticism and finger pointing. I don't really find that very constructive at this point. I think people have, by and large, done the best they could under very difficult and unprecedented circumstances.
Obviously, I mentioned you're running for re-election. Do you plan on campaigning with President Trump in the coming weeks?
I have not spent any time campaigning at all. I've been, virtually none. I am spending time traveling around the state, going to high schools and colleges and listening to the county judges and mayors and others tell me how what we have done, how that has met their need and where more needs to be done. The Save Our Stages Act is just one example of that, the work we're trying to do to help restaurants be available to reopen once the government officials allow it. That's been where my focus is. This is the strangest re-election that I've ever been through because it involves very little campaigning. It's basically doing the job I've already been elected to do.
Let me ask you one other thing, and I know you've been involved in politics long enough to remember back in the day when Republicans were really concerned about the budget deficit and about whether we'd ever be able to pay back what we owed. And I noticed just the other day that we crossed a new threshold that we haven't since World War II. We're now, our debt is now greater than our gross domestic product. That's historic. We ever going to be able to pay this back?
Well, we don't have any choice, and it is very distressing to be sure, but I view this as sort of a domestic equivalent to World War II when we were trying to defeat Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, which was an existential threat to our country and to the rest of the world. We didn't worry about deficits and debt, but you're absolutely right that this is not going away. This is not monopoly money. And the historic efforts that we've undertaken to try to keep the economy afloat and try to deal with the public health crisis has run up a huge tab. But now, after we get this under control, we need to turn on a bipartisan basis to addressing that debt and those deficits. No doubt about it.
You've been generous with your time, Senator. I just have one follow-up on that, because you are noting that we are in a time now, similar to what we faced during the last World War. Given those exigencies, sir, you look at the Democrats' plan, they want to spend $2 trillion more than the Republicans do. Why not, if we're at a time of war?
Well, I don't want to spend money giving millionaires and billionaires a tax cut. They want to reverse what we put in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which capped the deductibility of state and local taxes. And as you know, some of these places like New York and San Francisco, they have much, much higher taxes than we have in Texas. So basically what happens is you have Texans subsidizing millionaires and billionaires in places like San Francisco and New York. I just don't think that's fair. And so I'm not willing to go there.
Republican U.S. Senator John Cornyn is running for re-election in November. Senator Cornyn, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much.
While we generally try to stay clear of the political aspect of the coronavirus in this program, some events from this week have led us to believe that we needed to report some of the things going on politically regarding the pandemic, including the previous articles that we read. Here's an article, actually a pre-recorded report from the Texas Standard, about how political divides on COVID-19 could risk public health.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Odds are that what you think about the drug hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID-19 says a lot about your politics. The anti-malarial drug has received significant support from President Trump and other prominent conservatives, despite the National Institutes of Health cautioning against its use. But a poll by Politico and research company Morning Consult showed that while 71% of Republicans supported treating COVID-19 with hydroxychloroquine, only 29% of Democrats did. Support for other drugs falls along similar partisan lines, as do attitudes about mask wearing and social distancing. Clearly, partisanship has crept into our conversation about public health, but is this something truly new? Here to talk about that is Susan Gimo. She's a public health expert and professor of political science at Marquette University. Professor Gimo, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Why is this happening? Why is the efficacy of certain treatments, why is it turned into a partisan issue?
I think it's because the president has pretty much continuously questioned the science and questioned his own task force on COVID-19. And so I think he has, in large part, made it a partisan political issue. And I think he's fed into existing polarization in the electorate and has really made this pandemic a political partisan issue.
I wonder how much of this is actually linked to an erosion of confidence in other institutions, not just the presidency. Food and Drug Administration, for example, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that sort of thing.
There may be some of that, too, because and I think a lot has to do, too, with President Trump is and others who question some of the efficacy of the recommendations coming out of these institutions are tapping into a strong anti-science, anti-vaccination movement that predates this particular pandemic. So there was already, I think, a wealth of suspicion toward government institutions around things like vaccines. And I think the administration's flip-flopping or undermining of some of these organizations like the CDC reduces and erodes public trust in these institutions and what they're saying.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned science and questioning science. I guess in some ways this might not necessarily be that new a phenomenon on one level. I mean, we saw the politicization of global climate change, for example, global warming. How long have we been experiencing this, and are we noticing more perhaps because of the circumstances, or how do you see it?
Well, I think it's been around. I think the questioning of science has been around, and as I referred to already, the anti-vax movement. But I think climate change fits into that as well. I think what's different is that the president of the United States questions the science. And so that makes it gives it a voice, if you will. And it's not just fringe groups or people on the conspiracy theorists or people like that who are questioning it. But now it's given some legitimate weight because the president of the United States has said that. And now it's just carried over into the COVID-19 pandemic.
There seem to be clear dangers, though, when we're talking about politicizing medicine, especially in a pandemic. And one of the dangers is that if it is seen as a political argument and not an argument about best practices or what we have to do facing an imminent threat. I guess the question that I have for you, is this something that a society can collectively stop doing? You know, put the brakes on the politicization of medicine once that spiral gets going.
Well, I think there will be people who will continue to question the science. And part of the issue, too, is that the science keeps changing. This is a new virus. Some of the recommendations from the CDC and WHO have changed as the science has changed. Some of these organizations have come under political pressure, though, to change their recommendations. So it is very hard to stop this once it's in play. But I think the alternative to not believe the science is to allow the death toll to keep going up and the cases to keep exploding. And I think maybe eventually people will say enough is enough.
Professor, what does all this mean for, say, the next shoe that will drop, the rollout of a large-scale vaccine, for example, further down the road?
Well, there's a lot of hope that a vaccine will come online soon. There are a lot of different companies doing these clinical trials. But at the same time, I think there's some fear that it might be politicized and the timetable might be sped up for political purposes in time for the election. So I think that could worry some people. And we don't know what the long-term effects will be. I saw a poll where I think they said 3/4 of the respondents said they would take the vaccine if it was available. But if there are bad side effects that come out, then that might undermine public trust in it.
Susan Gimo is a public health expert and a professor of political science at Marquette University. Professor, thanks for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you.
Here's our final report for today. About 20% of Americans couldn't get needed medical care due to pandemic, poll shows.
When the coronavirus surged in hotspots across the country, hospitals got ready. Most canceled elective surgeries, and many doctors told sick patients to try to recuperate at home unless symptoms got really severe. Now, a new poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health finds that about one in every five Americans in major cities nationwide say they were unable to get needed medical care for a serious problem. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
When 28-year-old Katie Kinsey moved from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles in early March, she needed to find a new doctor. Then she got sick with symptoms frighteningly similar to COVID-19.
I had a sore throat. I had a debilitating cough. When I say debilitating, I mean I couldn't talk without coughing. I couldn't lay down at night without coughing.
Kinsey's a federal consultant. She was coughing through phone meetings. She got very fatigued and knew she needed to see a doctor soon.
I took my insurance card and I called every single number on it, started with primary cares, and all of them were booked.
Eventually, she went to urgent care, got an X-ray, and a diagnosis of severe bronchitis, but not COVID. She says she might have avoided months of illness had she been able to see a doctor sooner. In our poll, a majority of households in New York, Chicago, Houston, and Los Angeles say they had negative health consequences when they had to delay medical care for serious problems. In Kentucky, ER Dr. Ryan Stanton saw this a lot.
And so we had people come in with heart attacks after having chest pain for 3 or 4 days, or stroke patients who had had loss of function for several days, if not a week or so. And I'd ask them why they hadn't come in, and they would say almost universally they were afraid of COVID.
Despite hospital officials telling patients to come to the hospital with true emergencies. In Los Angeles, Dr. Anish Mahajan with Harbor UCLA Medical Center says there have been worrisome reports from the LA County Coroner's Office.
The number of people who have died at home in the last few months is much higher than the average number of people who die at home prior to the pandemic. Something is going on where patients are not coming in for care, and those folks who died at home may have died from COVID, but they may also have died from other conditions that they did not come in to get cared for.
Like many hospitals nationwide, Harbor UCLA canceled elective surgeries to make room for coronavirus patients. In our survey, about one-third of households in Chicago and Los Angeles with anyone unable to have surgery or elective procedures, and more than half of households in Houston and New York say it resulted in negative health consequences. In New York, surgical oncologist Dr. Jeffrey Drebin with Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center says at the height of the pandemic, he saw patients with advanced disease because they weren't getting routine cancer screening. And he says that could have tragic consequences.
The estimate is that simply the one-year reduction in mammography and colonoscopy will create 10,000 additional deaths over the next few years.
Now, delays in treatment aren't always an issue of life and death. They can make a big difference in the quality of life. 12-year-old Nicholas Noblet lives in Northridge, California. He has cerebral palsy and has used a wheelchair most of his life. Mother, Natalie Noblet.
And that is because the spasticity in his legs is a result of the CP. And that means his hamstrings, his hips, his calves, even his feet and his toes get really tight.
Nicholas has been helped by Botox injections, which loosen his muscles enough so he can wear shoes. Here's Nicholas.
I do have these really cool shoes that has a zipper around it, and they really help me. Because, well, one, they're really easy to get on, and two, they look so cool shoes.
And best of all, they stabilize him enough so he can walk with a walker.
I love those shoes, and I think they sort of love me, too.
Nicholas was due for Botox injections in early March, but that was canceled, and he went months without treatment. His feet curled so much he was unable to wear shoes or walk with a walker. Today, he's back on treatment, wearing shoes, and walking with a walker. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
And we should note that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is among NPR's financial supporters.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Friday, September 11th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael, and coming up next, we'll bring you national news from USA Today, followed by local news at 3 o'clock. Here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading this afternoon. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Don Evans says infrastructure investment needed to fulfill Permian's promise. City sales tax collection suffers worst month of 2020. Governor Abbott announces funding for I-20 Cotton Flat Interchange. From the Odessa American, Permian Basin road work nabs federal dollars. Council District 1, Davis wants a shot at District 1. Medical Center Hospital to loosen ER visitation. Those articles and more on the way at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and then the Wall Street Journal, of course, at 6 o'clock this evening. At 7 o'clock, I always like to remind you at the end of the week that we have our program called On the Lighter Side, which are funny narrations and readings that the volunteer brings you each week. So if you're in the mood to kind of lighten things up after, as we have every week, a long week of heavy news, please join us for On the Lighter Side tonight at 7. And as we also like to do on Fridays, we like to send you off on the weekend with kind of a fun, uplifting song, and we're going to do that again this week. Sunday is Mel Torme's birthday. He was born in 1925 on September 13th. So we'll leave you with a tune from Mel Torme from the Recording Library of West Texas. We'll be back next week at 1. Have a great weekend.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do what, 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 do what. It don't mean a thing, all you got to do is sing. Do what, 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 do what. It makes no difference if it's sweet or hot. Give that rhythm everything you've got. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do what, 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 do what. What good is music if it ain't possessing something sweet? If it ain't the melody, it ain't the music. There's something else that makes the tune complete. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do I, 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 do I.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 64 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Liz Hill, and this is USA Today. First article is titled, Like 9/11, COVID-19 has stripped away Americans' sense of security as they wonder how safe they really are. Written by Ryan Miller. Wendy Lansky said she had an irrational fear of supermarkets. She got sick with COVID-19 in March, and while she can't pinpoint her exact exposure, her hunch is that it was at the grocery store. She almost died in her battle with the disease, and she is one of many long haulers, or COVID-19 survivors, with lingering symptoms such as irregular heartbeat and partial hair loss. Lansky, 50, also survived another national tragedy that reshaped how many Americans view their sense of safety, the September 11th terror attacks. "I think there are a lot of parallels," Lansky said of the two.